and coached the men's golf. He is a graduate of BYU, where he earned his BA and his MA. He also won the Big Sky Conference Coach of the Year 15 times. And he wants me to be as brief as possible, so I'll go ahead and turn the time over to Mac.
I'm happy to be with you this afternoon, and I'll try to keep my mouth up close to this mic. It's my first time as a presenter. I've been here many years as a participant in the conference. But I think one thing I learned from being in Michael Quinn's 11:15 session is don't leave any time for questions or rebuttal. For those of you that were here, you know what I'm talking about. I would like to preface my presentation with just a few items here. On the table are two papers that I've written. I'm going to be pulling from those, quoting from them at times during the presentation. Some people have found them useful. If you would like to come and look through them and are interested, just put your name and address on the sheet with the clipboard, and I'll work with you getting you a copy just through the mail with a small handling charge. Also, if I make any remarks that hurt feelings, I'll be very sorry about that. My remarks are from my experiences, and my deductions come from those experiences. And I wouldn't want to say anything that would step on anyone else's beliefs. So please forgive that in advance. Also, if I use the term gay, lesbian only, it's not because I'm not aware that they're bisexual, transgendered, and other categories. It's just too big of a mouthful because I'm going to be saying those words really a lot in the next 50 minutes. Okay, and I understand this is a sensitive issue, and I'm going to proceed. On a journey that I've been on for the past 6 years, I'd like to share with you that journey that consisted of considerable heartbreak, frustration, disappointment, and discovery that began about 1994. This presentation is going to be about what it's like to find yourself in that hard spot between the church's intransigent position regarding gays and lesbians and what's to be learned and what I've learned about the truth and realities concerning homosexuality. It's going to be about doctrine versus policy, and it's going to be about the notion of infallibility. I believe my experiences will be quite representative of those experienced by tens of thousands of other parents of gay children throughout the church. My family is a fairly typical Mormon family. While I was on a mission to Denmark, my wife was in the presidency of the seminary. We met at BYU. After 3 months of courtship, we got married, and my first teaching assignment was at what was then called Church College of Hawaii, now BYUH, where I was assigned to be the basketball coach. We returned, and I've been at Weber State for 36 years after that. Our family was pretty typical in terms of both of my sons served missions, one to Japan, one to Brazil. They both had temple marriages, and they both do all the church things. And that's just to paint a picture of what our nuclear family was like, without mentioning my daughter, which I will now. My daughter was an outstanding college student. She graduated with honors as a top student in zoology at Weber State University in the pre-med program and went on to Colorado State University School of Veterinary Medicine. Her travels have been a little bit different from about 6 or 8 years ago. In terms of her role in the family as a typical Mormon family, she is now pretty much estranged from the church and is no longer active for good reasons that all of you are very aware of. When she came home during summer break after her second year from Colorado State, she called us into the TV room and quietly, with some sobbing, told us that She was, in fact, a gay person. We went and put our arms around her, my wife and I, and told her, that's all right, we already know that. It had come to our attention over a period of watching her in her growth and development, her personality, her activities for a great number of years. So we went through the normal procedure of having suspicions become reality, having doubts put to rest, and that final confirmation, no matter how much you think you've known ahead of time that it was coming, always is like a dart in the heart a little bit. But it's not because of the final recognition that you know you're gay. It's because of two things that are still hanging around. After you've been through adjusting with family and friends and how it's going to impact relationships and the normal procedure, which I won't spend time on, but the two things that surface and stay and stare at you and are still staring at you are, one, the clear reality that our daughter was now going to have to function in a homophobic society and church and be subjected to ridicule, rejection, verbal abuse, prejudice, discrimination, even the danger of physical assault up to and including murder. And that's not as far out as many of us may think. Just 6 months prior to my daughter completing medical school and place of work, two lesbian women were burned to death 90 miles south of where she settled in the Northwest. So it does happen. And what that means is your anguish is not over your son or daughter, in our case at least, being gay. The anguish is over her extended well-being for the rest of her life, being placed in the kind of society and circumstances she found herself. The other, of course, is in my case, the relationship of the issue with the church. Eventually, what was to be my very personal reaction to all of this, I would say, and I think my wife can confirm this, it was more philosophical, I think, than anything else. It was more one of beginning to question, why our daughter? Why me? Why us? Why do I know so little about homosexuality and sexual orientation? And why are there gay and lesbian persons? What are we supposed to do with this? How do we proceed? So from early on, my perception, rightly or wrongly, was that maybe this was some kind of a calling. And I like to think that maybe it was. In fact, I like to think of all of parents of gay, lesbian children are on a giant group mission of some type. I guess to educate, to help break down stereotypes, to help break down homophobic attitudes in the country, in the church, or wherever. At this time, then, I thought of the line in one of our well-known hymns, "Not I'll go where you want me to go, but rather I'll be what you want me to be, dear Lord." In this case, I'll be the parent of a gay child of God and all of that it may entail, and I'll take it and run with it and do the best I can. I knew our journey and quest for answers would be difficult. I believed that while emotions could act as a catalyst or driving force, it would be our intellect, our minds, combined with our hearts, that would help us most in our search. I recalled at that time the words of Hugh B. Brown, who said at one time that he admired men and women who had developed a questing spirit. Revelation, he says, may come from the laboratory, out of the test tube, out of the thinking mind, the inquiring soul, out of search and research. We must preserve freedom of the mind in the church and resist all efforts to suppress it. With this to kind of inspire me, I proceeded into the question of homosexuality and my church, the spiritual and moral implications. I'm not sure everyone goes through these exact stages, but I'm looking at some of my friends that I think have gone through these stages. And I refer to stage one as my reaction and my delving into the issue of homosexuality in my church. Stage one I referred to as working out a solution. And what that actually means is rejection. It means that I must accept that homosexuality, my gay daughter, the whole business was wrong, unacceptable, and move towards the only possible solution, namely to change my daughter from a gay person to a straight one. In doing this, you would follow the course prescribed by the church, I suppose, reading scriptures, praying, read church literature, go to church counseling, marry a heterosexual, go on a mission, get aversion therapy at BYU, you know, whatever might work. This was never a consideration for us from the very beginning. I can't say that's true for a lot of other couples that we know and have heard about. In fact, you might be surprised at the number of Mormon couples of gay children who never get out of stage one. They're still there now, and that's unfortunate to be in that state of denial with the church. Then nothing seems to work to get out of the pit that you place the child in, and to my way of thinking, yourselves. Next, you can go to stage two, which I refer to as working out a compromise. For me, this means going from rejection to some tolerance with qualified love. It essentially means that you can be gay, but you must remain celibate. This is kind of following the church's lead, where we essentially think we can't totally ignore you. We know you're there. Maybe we can't change you, so you just have to behave and don't cross the line and stay as inconspicuous as possible. We'll tolerate you, but we won't accept you. And don't expect to be a Boy Scout leader or a young women's camp counselor. And I say that because my daughter was a camp counselor prior to the time someone surmised that she might be a lesbian person, at which time she was removed from that job, and that started the downward slide with her relationship with the church, and has continued since that time. Third step is I've called working out, I've indicated stop trying to work out solutions and compromises and just accept with unconditional love your daughter, learn all you can and accept homosexuality for what it is. It took me probably 2 years to get out of stage two and move on. I like to refer to those stages one, two, and three as kind of a passive recovery period. And from there, I think you move into action. We did this, I think, first by becoming acquainted with a family fellowship program. And all I can tell you is that I think family fellowship is a community of common cause. I think a family fellowship offers a wellspring of love and a springboard to learning. This is a group that started back in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken. It had been going several years before we became part of it, but some couples got together with this common cause where they felt comfortable, they could talk to each other and share, and it has grown now to exceed 1,400 people. They have quarterly meetings. They have annual conferences. We have a newsletter. We have educational materials we just disperse. We have an email network. We offer counseling. It's a very broad and growing support system for persons like us, and we really try to help couples who find out that they have a gay or lesbian child, and we try to help the homosexual people as well. So I think without family fellowship, I can speak for myself, I might still be back in the late stages of stage two. They were a tremendous help, and I think will continue to be for long into the future. So in due time, a major question arises that has to be dealt with. What about the current church policy directed towards my daughter and all other gay and lesbian people? How can I go about dealing with this conflict of challenging the brethren, challenging the policy? How do so many people go about doing that when it's been so ingrained for so long? Is not an easy task. It's a hard line to cross over. But Upon reading something that I read about Joseph Smith, it kind of gave me the inspiration to go ahead and get on with it. Apparently, he was part of a church court for a party named Pelatiah Brown, who was brought up for a high council. The quote is that I did not like the man being called up for erring or questioning doctrine. It looked too much like the Methodists. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. And the best definition I could find for trammeled was intellectually shackled. So, with the shackles off, I was ready to proceed into the next area, which was to research the issue from a scientific point of view. I was, after all, a college professor, and that was where my nose turned first. I proceeded to read approximately 12 to 15 of the best books I could find. I attended 75 to 100 hours of lectures from Hammer on the H gene to experts in reparative therapy. I attended 200 to 300 hours of conferences and seminars, and more importantly, maybe I began to associate with gay and lesbian persons, their parents, and other family members for literally hundreds of hours. After I had done what I thought was a fairly complete job of researching that side of the issue, I came to this conclusion. Homosexuals are okay. They are a separate but equal creation. Homosexuality is natural for homosexuals. It is demographically stable at around 1 out of 20, and the phenomenon derives basically from interaction between genes, hormones, and other biological, emotional factors, and is immutable, meaning that the trait is hardwired and unchangeable. I would like to read just a small section from the paper that I referred to, which, by the way, is called The Pernicious Nature of Homophobia, the Biological, Physical, Psychological, etc. Dimensions of Homosexuality. So if you would, let me just read this much. I have a particular interest in the business of handedness because of a golf relationship. Homosexuality, a stable dimorphic biological trait expressed behaviorally, is the section I'm reading. One of the best ways for a non-scientist to understand the dynamics of biological trait as it happens to sexual orientation may be to look at sexual orientation within the context of its stable dimorphism. Dimorphism is defined as the existence within a species of two distinctions that differ in one or more characteristics, such as colorization, size, shape, etc. Sexual orientation fits this definition because there are at least two major distinctions in human sexuality, male and female. If sexual orientation is placed alongside another very common biological trait, handedness, it provides a very insightful comparison. This is true not only in such areas as distribution, male-female ratio, and correlation data, but also functions well as a working analogy. Handedness and sexual orientation both have a majority and minority orientation. Right-handedness, the majority orientation, is found in 92% of the population. The minority orientation, left-handedness, in 8%. Sexual orientation has a majority orientation, heterosexuality, found in 95% of the population, and a minority orientation, homosexuality, found in 5%. There is no correlation for handedness or homosexuality with race, age, geography, or culture. The age of appearance in both is approximately age 2. Neither orientation is chosen, and neither is pathological. Both traits run in families, and there is an increased incidence of siblings of left-handed and homosexual offspring having the minority orientation. Neither handedness nor sexual orientation can be verified simply by looking at a person. Both are internal orientations, and the only way to identify them is by their respective overt behaviors or external expressions. The interior orientation cannot be altered clinically, but the external expression can be. Consequently, left-handed people can learn to write or play golf right-handed, and homosexuals can learn to act out as heterosexuals. The internal biological trait, however, is not altered and cannot be. I only pause for 1 second and maybe remind you that two of the greatest golfers that ever lived, Ben Hogan and Johnny Miller, were both naturally left-handed. They chose to play golf right-handed because they wanted to use their dominant side as a strong pulling side to execute the golf swing. If you look at Johnny Miller today, you'll see that left hand curled up around writing when he's taking notes. He's still a naturally left-handed person. That internal trait did not change because he chose to play golf right-handed. Biologists have asked, what's in the box? Or in other words, what is this human trait that we can observe, study, and measure in each other? Researchers have accomplished this phase one objective for the trait of homosexuality. They are now rapidly answering questions about how does this box work? Scientists have opened the lid of the box, stuck their hand down into the genes and dendrites and hormones that create human traits, and are beginning to solve this mystery, the origins of sexual orientation. Their findings fly in the face of the homophobic mindset of many individuals and the homophobic dogma and policies of many organized Christian religions. I had a second conclusion from this investigation into the scientific arena, which was the understandings, attitudes, and beliefs that a great number of people have about homosexuality are unfounded, based upon fear, confusion, myth, and misinformation. From a purely scientific standpoint, church teachings about the basic nature of homosexuality are incompatible, in my way of thinking, with the broad consensus of scientific data. The work goes on, and the next challenge was to research the scriptures, at least for me. That is to say, the homosexuality and the Judeo-Christian morality. Much of today's anti-gay sentiment and homophobic rhetoric comes from the so-called religious right, primarily conservative Christian churches or allied groups promoting family values and other seemingly moral causes. The scriptures most often quoted are from the Old Testament, Genesis, the Sodomite story, and Leviticus, and in the New Testament from Romans. If you'll bear with me, I don't know if the gentleman's here who stood up and thought that the gays were going to lead everyone in America down the path to Sodom, but I would like to read about that story and give you my perspective of it from my research. I'm recalling still at Matthew Shepard's memorial service, someone was carrying a placard that said, "Hell awaits the Sodomites," and that's just typical, along with the sodomy laws and everything, that stigmatizes this particular story. This is my understanding. The consensus of scholarly interpretation placed on the brief story of Lot and Sodom is as follows. Sodomites were not homosexuals. The incident regarding the two angels invited by Lot to spend the night at his home has been the cause of much confusion and misinterpretation. Sodom was not destroyed because of rampant homosexuality, as some people suggest. It was destroyed because the inhabitants of Sodom were a wicked, greedy, selfish people who refused hospitality to strangers, the two angels, and even threatened to abuse them or to rape them as a sign of their contempt. God had already condemned the city in an earlier conversation with Abraham. The angels had been sent to give the city one last chance. Lot was violating the custom of Sodom by entertaining unknown guests within the city walls at night without obtaining permission from the city elders. When the people of Sodom surrounded Lot's house and demanded that Lot bring the stranger out in order that they should know them, it had nothing to do with homosexuality or homosexual acts. It was, in fact, a flagrant attempt by the mob to prevent the host Lot from providing genuine hospitality to strangers. In refusing the mob, Lot had placed the hospitality of his house, sacred even among a barbarous people, above the modesty of the two daughters he offered the crowd in place of the strangers. Subsequent to the Lot-Sodom story, neither the prophets nor Jesus ever mentioned homosexual acts or homosexual orientation in conjunction with this incident. These Old Testament passages do not provide a viable scriptural argument against homosexuality. Joseph Smith confirmed his belief in this interpretation, and it's unfortunate that many years later, Spencer W. Kimball still goes back to the term Sodomites and uses it in Chapter 6 of Miracle of Forgiveness. Leviticus. In the 18th and 20th chapters of Leviticus, it is stated that man must not lie with man as with woman, and such action would be considered an abomination, and violators would be put to death. The Old Testament uses abomination liberally, like an abomination to sacrifice a bull or sheep with a defect or blemish. Thus, even many trivial things were an abomination. The passages above are actually part of what the Bible scholars call the Holiness Code, which was given to the Israelites by Moses. The code was concerned not with intrinsic wrong of various acts, but with the question of ritual purity. The code banned homosexual acts, probably because no one understood what it was, but it also prohibited eating raw meat, tattoos, wearing garments of two different yarns, adultery, etc., all listed as abominations and punishable by death. Only selective literalists would single out one specific part of the ritual code for suiting his or her predetermined purposes. In the case in question, that would mean perpetuation of the ignorant spirit of bigotry and hatred against gay and lesbian people. Outside the holiness code of ritual purity, there is no mention of homosexual relations in the Old Testament. The Leviticus argument joins the Sodom one in the dump heap of antiquity as far as credible justification for scriptural condemnation of gays and lesbians. The New Testament, Paul. Although references in 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy have sometimes been translated in this century in such a way as to suggest that Paul was referring to homosexuality, it is unlikely. The New Testament passage most often cited in connection with homosexuality is in Romans 1, 26 and 7, having to do with exchanging natural intercourse for unnatural. Many theologians believe Paul's main concern here was not with sexuality, but with theology. There was a time when monotheism was offered to or known by the Romans, but they rejected it. The reference to homosexuality is simply a mundane analogy to this theological sin. It is patently not the crux of the argument. Once the point has been made, the subject of homosexuality is quickly dropped and the major argument resumes. Paul is saying, in other words, that as Romans rejected the worship of one God for the worship of many gods, so they rejected opposite sex for same-sex relations. The persons Paul condemns are manifestly not homosexuals. The whole point of Romans 1, in fact, is to stigmatize persons who have rejected their calling and gotten off the true path they were once on. In Paul's time and place, to be sure, this analogy between theology and sexuality worked because only heterosexuality was viewed as natural. It was not understood then, as we do now, that for some people it is homosexuality, not heterosexuality, that comes naturally. Paul's analogy in our enlightened age about the naturalness of homosexuality would not wash. In total, references to homosexuality are seen as an attempt to deal with the saints in Rome in regards to troublesome matters of pagan idolatry, monotheism, cultic prostitution, etc., not with homosexuality as such. The use of the New Testament to make contemporary political arguments about homosexuality is fraught with irony. Among many Christian prohibitionists today, opposing the homosexual agenda is a central feature of their campaign for a more moral society. Yet in the four Gospels, the founder of the Christian religion makes no reference to homosexual acts whatsoever, not a single one. My personal observation, I'd just like to add on relative to Paul. To me, there's no evidence that Paul was knowledgeable at all about the complexities of sexual orientation, and I don't think we can take literally and apply now everything Paul had to say. Otherwise, we'd have to deal with issues of celibacy, of women praying in church, of length of hair, and a number of other things that Paul was just using in his own way for his own purposes. Most of the time, Paul used references to homosexuality. They were isolated, and they were used to make a point or used for an analogy, not as a principal or consistent gospel component. Another thing that came to my mind was that Peter was the one who received the keys of presidency at the time of the Savior's death for the early church. He was a contemporary of Paul and Paul's ecclesiastical superior, yet Peter had nothing to say about homosexuality at all. In conclusion, the point that emerges then is from a careful study of biblical passages that are invoked in attacks on homosexuality is that one cannot divorce them from their historical, cultural, and textual settings. The unfortunate fact is that some people have had their own motives for wrenching certain lines out of context with the consequence that the idea of homosexuality as a violation of Christian teachings has in recent centuries become ingrained in the minds of most people in the Western world. Then I turned my attention to my own church scriptures, what we call Latter-day Scriptures. And if you listen closely, I will take a few moments and read to you all references found in Latter-day Scriptural works of the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and Pearl of Great Price. There you have it. Not a chapter. Not a verse, not a word. Incredulous. This is a church policy affecting tens of thousands of church members, constituting about 5% of the church population, and the policy is implemented without any real guidelines from modern-day scriptures or from the church founder, Joseph Smith, or from any documented revelation. I love that passage that Michael read this morning in 1 Nephi. Were all of you present to hear that, or can I just take a second and repeat it? There's one passage in the Book of Mormon that does seem terribly pertinent to this discussion. It's the last verse in 1 Nephi chapter 26. From Nephi, "All are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile, black and white, bond and free, male and female." I turned the words just a little bit, that's the gist of it. Nephi says the Lord welcomes all who come to him, regardless of sex, race, skin color, ethnicity, or religion. In our day, Nephi would probably have added sexual orientation, and it would read, "All are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile, black and white, bond and free, male and female, homosexual and heterosexual." I feel certain of it. The next thing I wanted to do, then, finding no scriptural evidence anyplace, I wanted to trace where this policy began in the church. So I did a little research on the evolution of the LDS policy. What was going on in the restored church relative to homosexuals and homosexuality from 1830 to 1950? The answer is not much. For 120 years of church history, the church just flowed with the times and the culture. From Michael Quinn in Same-Sex Dynamics, the following: LDS leaders who reached adulthood in the 19th century were remarkably restrained and tolerant when they confronted homoeroticism or homosexuality among the Latter-day Saints. In other words, not much action, not called to church courts, no discipline. I could go through and tell you about a whole host of people you're probably already familiar with during those times, the David and Jonathan persons in the primary or relief society, and a number of others. But what I will do is give you this one example of how the moral code of the church was working at that time, the perceptions, the action. Within a three-year period, Apostle Richard R. Lyme was excommunicated for adultery, while church patriarch Joseph F. Smith, an acknowledged homosexual who was in that capacity from 1942 to 1946, was quietly released by the First Presidency in a very informal and mild response for engaging in same-sex activity. That wouldn't be the case, of course, today. In the 1940s, Spencer W. Kimball started counseling young men about same-sex desires and later began advocating marriage as a remedy for such. For Kimball, even at this time, people were not homosexual, only acts were. If you look carefully at the wording of press releases and general conference addresses, you'll see that that philosophy and position has not changed much since that time. As long as church leaders refer to gay and lesbian peoples as so-called homosexuals and say refer to themselves as, what they're essentially doing is refusing gays an identity. And they're saying that basically homosexuals are just heterosexuals with homosexual problems. That goes a long way to destroy a person's esteem, to make them feel unworthy, etc. And it's unfortunate that after almost 60 years, that same prevailing philosophy is still with us. I might mention this about President Kimball. It's ironic to me that the person the church leader who was instrumental in getting black persons out of the penalty box was the point man in establishing a policy that put homosexual persons back in the penalty box. With his book and with his counseling and with his having gays try to get married to solve their problems, President Spencer W. Kimball at the time was probably one of the most influential in moving us towards the present policy that we have. There was increased homophobia in the 1950s. In 1968, the General Handbook of Instructions finally added homosexual acts to the list of sins for which excommunication was appropriate. In 1976, LDS headquarters replaced homosexual acts with homosexuality as grounds for excommunication, making Mormons vulnerable to church punishment for their homosexual orientation only. In the 80s and 90s, strong rhetoric from church leaders likening homosexuality to pedophilia, incest, drug addiction, abortion, other violent crimes. Currently, the rhetoric has subsided somewhat, but the basic teachings about the nature of homosexuality and reparative therapy continue. Interestingly, the moral code for homosexuality has reverted back to 1968 version, where church discipline will come only if you cross the line and engage in homosexual activities. So it's been an off-again, on-again. It's vacillated. There never has been anything really concrete. In my opinion, this constitutes a policy that just evolved. It categorically, for me, is not from divine revelation. I ask myself, if a revelation for the church at large was ever given by the Lord for this issue, through a prophet, when was it given, to whom, where is it documented as such, and where can I find it in the canonized scripture? At this point, I began to speculate in a manner similar to Terry Tempest Williams. She wrote the following in her new book, Leap. What happens when our institutions no longer serve us, no longer reflect the truth of our experience? What we know is not what we hear. To me, this is the hard spot. This is the crux of the matter. What do we do when our institution no longer reflects the truth of our experience? Everyone who's had a gay or lesbian son or daughter and has been through the same journey I've been through, I think, comes to this conclusion. This is where the hard spot is. Someone asked me recently, what kind of impact has this issue, with all of its implications, had on your faith, testimony, and your relationship to the church? Well, I've become wiser. I think I've become stronger. And partly, in answer to that question, I've made two very important distinctions. One, there's a difference between doctrine and policy. And two, there's a difference between gospel and church. I interpret gospel and doctrine to be those eternal truths, principles, and ordinances necessary for my personal salvation and the salvation of my family. I believe church and policy, however, to be temporal, fallible, institutional administration and procedures where mistakes in decision-making and interpretations are possible. In this light, I would like to discuss two major decisions made by church leaders that I believe fall into the church policy category. They are restriction of blacks having the priesthood, and second, the present policies directed toward gays. For me, it points out, one, an interesting precedent, and two, makes for an interesting comparison. Both of these policies target significant minority populations that have been and still are victims of cultural discrimination. Two, the end result of both policies was and is to punish blacks and gays from functioning in full fellowship in the church unless they did the impossible, change their skin color or their sexual orientation. Three, rather than being lightning bolt clear and definitive, the origins of these policies seem to be muddled, confused, and shrouded in obscurity. Four, there appears to be no empirical or even persuasive circumstantial evidence that the priesthood policy originates with church founder Joseph Smith. Similarly, the prophet said nothing, wrote nothing, taught nothing, indicating any necessity of any policy directed toward gay and lesbians. 5, there's no evidence of any official revelation given by the Lord to the body of the church through a church prophet for either the priesthood policy or the homosexual policy. 6, neither the priesthood policy nor the gay lesbian policy could pass the Hugh B. Brown litmus test for determining whether a church doctrine or policy becomes binding upon church members or not. Namely, it has to be reviewed by the brethren. It has to be submitted to the highest councils of the church. And finally, it has to be approved by the whole body of the church. I can't remember the last time that ever happened in any kind of significant manner. Reminded me of what I read about the old days when the prophet used to collect his council of 50 made up of the brethren of the church and their spouses. They would review, ask questions, go over the revelations before they would be approved and finally canonized and put in the scriptures. No reasonable case can be made for justifying either policy by an unbiased interpretation and application of scripture. 8, the priesthood restriction evidently became an official church policy when Brigham Young announced it to be such in 1852. It remained relatively unchallenged for the next 120 years. The gay policy evolved mysteriously through the 50s and 60s and got into church handbooks by 1968. It has remained relatively unchanged for the last 32 years. Unchallenged, pardon me. 9, the priesthood policy was rescinded in 1978, at which time, to my way of thinking, all the basic pillars upon which the policy was established collapsed. The reversal of this policy is found in Scripture Declaration 2. It is my hope that someday soon the gay policy will also be changed and entered into the Scriptures as Declaration 3. It is my humble opinion that these two decisions are flawed policies, not divine revelation or doctrine. In conclusion, how would this model work for me, this gospel doctrine versus church policy notion? Well, for example, if you read in the paper that a missionary couple had been called to go out to the southwest banks of the Utah Lake, clear the area, plant different kinds of grains, rye and so on, to entice bird habitation, geese, chuckers, pheasants, whatever, to come in and live there, and then invite the hunters to come and sell them permits so they could shoot the birds so that the money taken in from the permits could be put into the church coffers, then I would probably write a letter to the Deseret News and the Standard Examiner, which I did, which were both published, indicating my contempt for doing something that I thought was totally against scriptural basis and against all of the early teachings of early prophets of the church, the destruction of God's lesser creations for sport and for money, simply indicated to me some inkling from the 8th chapter of Mormon, where I asked this question to myself: is the Holy Church of God so caught up in money, with money and substance and the adornment of its churches, that it endorses and promotes the sacrifice of principle for profit? This is not the only one of those enterprises. The church has one up at Deseret Land and Livestock where you can get a $6,000 elk by being taken in by church officials on church property, and we have places in Florida and places all over. Well, I don't like that. I disagree very strongly with it. And what would I say about that in terms of the discussion is, this would have nothing for me to do with whether heavenly personages visited the earth to restore the fullness of the gospel to Joseph Smith. I distinguished between this church policy, which I think is a very poor one, and what constitutes for me the gospel or doctrine. If a flawed policy denied blacks the priesthood for 126 years, for me, it doesn't influence my belief in the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. If I have a disagreement with church leadership on the gay issue, it doesn't take away from my belief that the comprehensive plan of salvation found in the restored gospel still represents the most logical and meaningful answers to questions of my origin, purpose, and destiny, and how the human soul fits into the endlessness of space and the endlessness of time. This is another thing that this would let me do. This approach allowed me to share a lecture with Warren Aston, who wrote In the Footsteps of Lehi, the 2nd through 18th chapters. He's an explorer that's been down in the southern coast of Arabia. I can stand up and give a lecture with him and bear witness to the fact that we've probably found the ancient bountiful and the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. And the following Saturday, I can go march in the gay pride parade. And that's okay with me. I can work with that. Lastly, the road to activism, I guess I call this one. After all the previous discussion, I finally have reached a point where I'm ready to stride out and start doing some things that maybe others wouldn't want to do. I've come to believe, as Paul Toscano does, that responsible dissent possesses the spiritual power to awaken consciousness, raise awareness, create paradigms, alter opinions, heal wounds, and bring wholeness and holiness to our church community. So I began writing letters. I sent this paper to the top 15 brethren in Salt Lake in 1966. I had two responses, one from President Monson, who said, pardon? 96. What did I say? Thanks. Sent my paper to the top 15 members of the hierarchy of the church and received a response from Elder Monson that essentially said, talk to your local priesthood leaders. And I received one other one that referred me to Dallin Oaks' article in the Ensign. That wasn't very satisfying, so I wrote big, long, six-page letters to President. Anybody there? Does anybody care? Every day the situation deteriorates. More families torn apart. More temple marriages dissolved. More suicide. Of course, I've written a lot of letters to the editor and get a lot of flack up in Ogden for doing so, but in September of 1990 to those two, titled Church and Homosexuality, and it says, Brethren, this letter is written with humility and great hope. We're still a community within the church that continues to feel ignored, disenfranchised, ostracized, and angry. The problem is not going away. Some believe the greatest challenge for the church in the 21st century will be dealing with the diverse nature of church membership, including the issue of homosexuality. After years of conscientious effort on the part of Mormon parents of gay and lesbian children to initiate some kind of meaningful dialogue with church leadership, we perceive little or no progress in that direction. We know you're truly there. We hope you truly care. As a next stop, may I be presumptuous enough to suggest the following? And then I proceeded to say, let's get together for a one-day retreat. You two and your wives, meet with some of us, and let's just talk. We'll have an opening prayer and an hour-long testimony meeting. Then we'll have a light buffet, and we'll just spend the whole day talking about this subject. When I ran this idea past some of our close friends who had gay and lesbian children, they asked me what I had been smoking. Then I asked the brethren, were they right or could they be proven wrong? Just egging them to please, let's make them wrong. I did receive a phone call from Marlon Jensen, a personal one. He called me by first name. He said, Dallin and I have both read the letter, and we'd love to respond to it, but it's so close to conference that we just don't have the time right now. But as soon as conference is over, I will get back in touch with you. It might not be with the forum that you're looking for, but we'll do something. Well, I waited through October and November and most of December. And by that time, I ran out of patience. So I had been working on a petition that I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I felt like I wanted to write it. So what I'm going to do now is have Val go back and dim the lights, and I'm going to have Kim put the first transparency up on the screen, and I'll read this petition. For those of you that are in the very back and can't read it, I will do that here. And I would just like to show you where I went with the next step. petition to the general authorities of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from gay and lesbian Mormons, their parents, other family members, and friends. Because of the pain, indignity, humiliation, and despair being endured by hundreds of thousands of gay and lesbian Mormons and their families, and because all options extended to gay and lesbian members by leaders are demeaning, inhumane, and in some instances outright destructive, namely, stay in the church and live a life of fear, anxiety, and frustration as a closeted gay or lesbian member, two, stay in the church as an out homosexual, remain celibate and be denied one of life's most basic needs, an intimate, loving, caring, sharing, committed relationship with another human being, three, leave the church, four, be excommunicated, or five, commit suicide. Because the primary cause of the suffering and disillusionment of this large segment of our church community is the position taken by current church leaders regarding homosexuality and the policies that are directed toward gay and lesbian members of the church, we, the undersigned, petition you, the general authorities of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, to reconsider and then change present church policy as they pertain to homosexuality and the status of gay and lesbian members. I thought up this group name, Mormon Advocates for Further Light and Knowledge, that some of you will relate to as you make the three knocks and are ready to pass into the next stage. I wanted them to know that I've been there. I'm an insider. I'm asking you, representing a whole host of us, will you please get on your knees and take the necessary steps to see if there's further light and knowledge that would direct where we go with this issue. Our rationale for this petition is as follows. We believe the position taken by the church regarding the basic nature of homosexuality is flawed and in dramatic conflict with the consensus of scientific data. The church teaches that same-sex attraction is a negative, unwanted, and apparently unnatural emotion, which, when acted upon, results in sinful behavior regardless of the love, stability, and commitment that is evident in a significant percentage of homosexual relationships. Church leaders suggest that any such inclination for homosexuality should be diminished or overcome. Describing homosexual persons in recent times, church leaders have used phrases such as so-called homosexuals, those who profess homosexuality, and those who refer to themselves as gay and lesbian. And in the 99 Ensign article, Assistant Commissioner of Family Services used phrases like struggles with same-sex attraction, has homosexual difficulties when referring. The inference to me in both cases seems clear. Rather than accepting the reality that homosexuals are in fact independent and equal creations of God, it appears as though we are asked to believe that gay and lesbian may just be closeted or pretending heterosexuals suffering from homosexual problems. Should we also conclude that homosexuality is essentially a misnomer, that as a complete and natural entity, homosexuals do not or should not exist? The church publication, Understanding and Helping Those Who Have Homosexual Problems, distributed to bishops and other church leaders in 1992, we find the following statement. I find this terribly significant myself. When homosexual difficulties have been fully resolved, heterosexual feelings can emerge. Does this mean that a gay or lesbian person who used to have bad homosexual feelings is now a homosexual with good heterosexual feelings? Or does it mean that such a person has always been a heterosexual and has just overcome his or her homosexual difficulties? Among those failed practices employed by the church in dealing with gay and lesbian members during the 1970s and 80s, which demonstrated a profound lack of understanding regarding homosexuality, two are particularly noteworthy. The medieval practice of aversion therapy, where the arms, genitals, or other parts of gays and lesbians received electric shock while they were reviewing sexually explicit materials in an attempt to modify their sexual orientation. And two, counseling homosexual members to marry heterosexuals as a remedy for their condition. It is our perception that church leaders remain in denial about the realities of homosexuality. If true, could this be because it's the safest place to go to protect the image of the church and retain the respect and praise of the world? That's another reference to Mormon 8th chapter. Certainly, accepting these realities and dealing with them within the context of present church policy would be difficult, but we believe the time has come to do so. As we continue to seek out ultimate truths about the extremely complex issue of human sexuality, we believe we can build upon at least one basic premise. While the etiology of sexual orientation is likely multifactorial, empirical scientific evidence suggests that in the vast majority of cases, this phenomenon is a genetic, hormonal, natural, dimorphic, biological trait that is neither chosen nor changeable. This underscores the obvious and undeniable reality that homosexuality is about who you are, not what you do. This being true, as homosexual persons are, God has created them. Thus, to condemn them is to condemn their maker. B, we believe that whereas there is ample evidence to support establishing church policy relative to relationship between men and women, the scriptures offer little to help formulate policy on the question of homosexuality. And then I go through the scriptures there, which would just be repetitious, so I'll skip to C. We have no indication of any church policy directed towards gay and lesbians for the first 125 years of church history. It appears as though official statements, etc. That's also repetitious. Go to D. And we talk about the counseling and the trait right-handed. I won't repeat that. E, we do not believe that God has revealed all there is to know about some of life's great mysteries, including human sexual orientation. The ninth article of faith states that we believe God will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. In the grand design and purpose of our Heavenly Father, who knows for sure why 3-5% of his children are homosexual? And then I repeat the scripture in 1 Nephi. F, until a full and comprehensive knowledge of the plan of eternal progression is known regarding Lord's gay and lesbian children, we believe church leaders should extend to them unqualified acceptance and love and welcome them into full fellowship in the restored church. We believe the church should support legislation that would promote the civil rights of homosexuals through measures such as same-sex partnerships, which have been legalized in several Scandinavian countries, Holland, and now in Vermont. The church's moral code could then be applied equitably to couples in heterosexual marriages and same-sex partnerships. The church's tenacious resistance to accepting homosexuality as morally neutral appears to be based upon an assumption that to do so would deal a devastating blow to the viability of family as the cornerstone of social life. Thoughtful analysis of this assumption calls it seriously into question. Gays and lesbians are characteristically loving, devoted members of families. If the family fails as an institution in our society generally, it will not be a result of our extending Christian tolerance to homosexuals or from recognizing that their paths will necessarily differ from the heterosexual persons in some respects. G, we believe church leaders should take action to repudiate and then remove from church-approved reading materials any statements about homosexuality that are false, misleading, or inflammatory. Remarks made by a church apostle during the priesthood session of General Conference, October 1976, are a prime example. In that talk, the speaker validated the behavior of a missionary who had floored his gay companion. "Well, thanks," he said. "Someone had to do it, and it wouldn't be well for a general authority to solve the problem that way." If any of you are not aware of the little booklet, I have a copy, and I picked it up at the distribution center not 6 months ago. It's a 1999 version. It has not been edited. The same inflammatory remarks are in that new printout. I went to try to find the ensign that has the conference reports of November 1976. This talk is not in there. Why was this talk excluded from the conference report section of the November ensign? Why does the 1999 reprint of this talk found in the pamphlet Two Young Men Only still contain these questionable comments? In the popular church book, Miracle of Forgiveness, a grossly inaccurate inference is made that homosexuals are predisposed to bestiality. In chapter 6, it states, "Perhaps as an extension of homosexual practices, men and women have sunk even to seeking sexual satisfaction with animals." We believe these statements and others coming from high-ranking church leaders who continue to equate homosexuality with incest, pedophilia, drug addiction, violent crime, etc., may be contributing to the widespread homophobia that exists within the church. And finally, for 126 years, Latter-day Saints were told by church leaders that descendants of Cain were cursed insofar as receiving the priesthood, would go down unto death, before receiving the priesthood, and could never hold the priesthood until all of their descendants of Adam received the blessings of the priesthood and the keys thereof. The basic reason given for this church policy was the speculation that while in the pre-existence, blacks had been less valiant or had rejected the priesthood there. When this policy was rescinded in 1978, all of the basic pillars upon which had been constructed collapsed. One apostle, that would have been McConkie, was even quoted as saying to a reporter, "Forgive me, I was wrong, wasn't I? And so were a lot of others. What a tragedy if in the future some of you would have to say the same regarding the policy on homosexuality." President Kimball and other church leaders in the 70s did not originate the policy which restricted blacks from holding the priesthood. They inherited it and eventually changed it. As current church leaders, you did not originate the present policy concerning gays and lesbians. You inherited it. We petition you to reconsider and then change the current church position relative to our homosexual brothers and sisters, and thus welcome yet another disenfranchised segment of our church community into full membership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. To do so would be an expression of love and concern for the welfare of individuals consistent with the highest standards of Christianity. I personally mailed individual copies of this petition to 125 church authorities, from President Hinckley to the Second Quorum of 70 to the presidencies of the Primary Relief Society and Young Women. I used a P.O. box for a return response, and to this date have nothing, no response at all. So, for your information, there is a body of people who are now presently investigating the possibility of putting this petition in local Salt Lake newspapers as a political advocacy ad. Anyone interested in getting involved in such a thing, pick up a copy of the petition. You're welcome to get a hold of me or get on our email, macandlaurie@aol.com. We've already got 250 people, 11 countries represented, and most of the states, who are not only willing to sign the petition, but to help underwrite costs to have it published. And I hate to do it, and there's always a danger that you just cause the brethren to dig in. But after 6 years of patient lobbying and attempting to set up some kind of a dialogue, some of us are just running out of patience and are willing to stick our necks on the line a little bit to see if something in the press, something public, would help do anything to set that dialogue in motion. What am I going to do from here? See how the petition goes. Continue to lecture. Continue to write papers. Continue to try to do away with homophobia and try to do what a lot of you are doing. Just keep on the trail. Thank you very much.